The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Maya Nicholson, Internet Lawfare, with an episode from the Lawfare Archive for May 4th, 2024. As the Israel-Hamas conflict continues into its seventh month, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has faced criticism for his handling of operations in Gaza and the humanitarian toll the war has taken in the region. Most recently, there have been concerns that the International Criminal Court will issue arrest warrants for Netanyahu, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, and other senior officials. For today's episode, I chose an episode from March 7, 2015. In the episode, Benjamin Wittes spoke with Natan Sachs about Netanyahu's controversial address to a joint session of Congress in 2015. They unpacked the speech, including what it meant for the U.S.-Israeli relationship, the ongoing nuclear talks with Iran at the time, and more.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 7th, 2015. That is my Brookings colleague, Natan Sachs, Israel Watcher. If you're not following his ongoing blogging on the Merkaz blog on the ongoing Israeli electoral saga, you're missing out. Natan joined me in my office this week to talk about Bibi Netanyahu's visit to Washington, his speech before the U.S. Congress, its impact on the U.S.-Israel relationship, and how all of this plays in the Israeli elections that are barely 2 weeks away. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Natan Sachs on Bibi's visit to Washington. So, Natan, it is not every day the Prime Minister of Israel comes to Washington against the will of the executive branch to give a speech before one party in Congress. How did this all happen, and what do you attribute it to?
It's certainly not every day. This is the third time that Bibi's spoken to a joint session of Congress, which ties Winston Churchill, which is a major figure in Bibi's mind. He also got a bust of Winston Churchill from Speaker Boehner, by the way. This speech is a combination of a few things. First and foremost, it's an attempt by Bibi to fight off what he sees as a very dangerous framework deal offered to the Iranians by the P5 plus one, led by the Americans. And I think that's genuine to a certain degree. I think he came here to try and fight it off. You can question whether coming here to speak before Congress publicly against the will of the president is the right way to fight it off. You could question the timing of it, which many people suspect was suspiciously close to the Israeli elections. You could question whether it's a good idea in the first place to speak to a legislator when the president and the chief executive of the country opposes it so vigorously. In the frame of Bibi Netanyahu, you could see the vice president was not behind him. He was not presiding over the Senate. Instead, the president pro tempore, Orrin Hatch, was presiding. Vice President Biden conveniently is in Guatemala this week. He has something else to do, and I don't think that's a coincidence. So this all came about, first and foremost, because Bibi wanted to stave off this deal. It also came about because he has an interest in portraying himself as the defender of Israeli security in Israeli voters' minds. And he has a wider interest in shifting the debate in the Israeli public towards national security and away from domestic issues. His home turf, where he's very strong electorally, is on national security and foreign policy. And on domestic issues, he's very vulnerable. He's actually quite weak.
So, okay, let's unpack this. How much of this is about Iran, and how much of this is about Bibi's domestic politics?
Well, I can't give you percentages in terms of the speech itself, the decision. That sort of depends on your level of cynicism and how cynical you think Netanyahu is. And as I have this operating rule, which is I assume less cynicism, although I suspect more. And the reason I assume less in this case, too, is that Bibi's a true believer on these issues on Iran. What you heard him say was not just grandstanding. He's been saying this for many years, and in a way that he doesn't say other things. This really is core belief. And I do think he really does believe that the agreement that he claims has been offered to Iran is truly dangerous. That said, the timing, the venue, everything is too convenient for politics to say that didn't play a role. So I think it played an important role with some mix of the two, maybe about even. Certainly, the timing is very suspicious. And moreover, it's, you know, if you think of Netanyahu himself, his career started and really took off when he was ambassador to the UN for Israel. And his best skill, and I think he's very good at it, is speaking in English about Israeli security. He grew up partly in the United States. His father was a professor here. And he knows how to speak in English to Americans, not just in the language of English, but in American speak, about Israeli defense, about Israeli security, about the concerns of Israelis. And so him doing this, one of the reactions immediately after the speech, someone was saying, could you imagine opposition leader Herzog doing that and getting that kind of reception? And the obvious answer is no. Herzog has many qualities, but this ability is not one of them. And that comparison, I think, is very important to him. But I think we should remember the issues are huge, and he believes it truly. That's also the main reason the president of the United States was so angry. It's not about protocol. It's not even about the timing. They're angry because they disagree fundamentally about the Iran negotiations.
And I guess the cynic in me says he's disagreed about the Iran negotiations for many months since the interim arrangement. He will disagree 3 weeks from now. Yet he comes at a time when the election is not just pending, but really impending in a very immediate sense. And he does it in this secretive way, at least secretive from the executive branch, almost with a thumb in the eye of the White House. Why did they play it that way? What's the benefit to Bibi of playing it in as in your face a way as he did with respect to the Obama administration?
I think there are two reasonable interpretations. One is that they messed up partly. I don't think they really understand just how badly this is perceived by Democrats, not just the president, because relations with the president for the prime minister have been so bad for a long time that that's sort of a given. And in particular, this move really is an attempt to stave off of the president's policy. So there's no way around a confrontation with the president. What's really new here is that there's a huge confrontation with Democrats writ large. By doing this way, they've really angered so many Democrats. Nancy Pelosi was at the speech, but her body language was clearly negative, and she came out and scathingly speaking about the speech. And there were many Democrats who weren't there. About a quarter of the Democrats weren't even there. And that's a big deal. That's the party of Harry Truman that recognized Israel 11 minutes after it was declared, and it's the party of most Jews in the United States, and it's traditionally been the pro-Israel party, and that might be shifting to a certain degree. Why they do it this way? I think on the one hand, it's a mistake, and it partly comes perhaps from the fact that they, and by they I mean Prime Minister Netanyahu and his ambassador here, Ron Dermer, are naturally players in the more Republican scene. Ron Dermer is an American-born, he's an Israeli, of course, now, and he, in fact, worked for Republican campaigns. There's nothing wrong with that inherently, but it does mean that it's harder for him perhaps to operate within Democratic circles as it might be for others. The other reason is that I think something snapped perhaps around the interim agreement, where it seemed like Netanyahu had sort of given up on the possibility that Obama would follow a strategy that Netanyahu liked or could live with. But I think this has become more acute for them. The negotiations with Iran are ongoing right now. And from the Israeli perspective, I think the agreement, the framework agreement that was proposed to the Iranians is severe enough to cause this kind of reaction. So I think there is a substantive argument to be made that it had to be around now. That doesn't mean it needs to be 2 weeks before the elections, but this is very different from the summer. In the summer, there was no framework agreement on the table, as far as we know. Now there is. And the Israelis are privy, or at least were privy until this crisis, to what the Americans were doing.
So how does this play in Israel? On the one hand, the optics are great. You know, you have the U.S. Congress giving the Prime Minister repeated standing ovations. The absences are much less glaring to an Israeli audience than they are to an American audience. You have apparent receptivity to his message in a very strong fashion. On the other hand, there has been a great deal of hand-wringing about the damage to U.S.-Israel relations and specifically to the erosion of the bipartisanship of support for Israel. So at the end of the day, is this play as Bibi, the statesman, talking in English about Israeli security, or does this play as Bibi, the cynic, using that as a stage piece for a very destructive exercise in dismantling the bipartisan support for Israel that has existed for a long time? How do Israelis, such as they have a unified opinion about anything, understand what just happened in Washington?
I think they understand it as all of the above, as odd as that might sound. Bibi's a very well-known commodity. He's been around for so long. He's the second longest serving prime minister. It's been 6 years in a row now. And so Israelis are used to this. And to this, I mean both his very bad relations with American presidents. He's had only Democrats to his dismay. He's had Clinton and now Obama, and very bad relations with both, especially Obama. But also Bibi, who's able to speak abroad, etc., as you described it. So there's been a lot of play in Israeli press about the crisis with the president in particular. There's been some about the partisan issue, but to be perfectly honest, that's a bit sophisticated. If you think of the foreign politics of another country, it's naturally hard for people who have real jobs to follow that. And they care a bit less. The differences between Democrats and Republicans don't seem so glaring from abroad. And so the crisis with the president is very obvious. The details of exactly who the senators are who are angry with Netanyahu, that's a little harder for people abroad to figure out. Now, the president himself is unpopular in Israel. So fighting with this president, as opposed to Clinton, doesn't have nearly as bad a cost as it did. When Bibi fought with Clinton, or argued with Clinton frequently, between 96 and 99 when he was prime minister, he paid a huge political price for it, and Clinton was quite active in trying to bring about Bibi's defeat. And in 99, when Bibi lost in a landslide to Barak, part of that, not all of that, but certainly some part of that, was because of his bad relations with the United States. He doesn't pay the same price now. When Israelis are asked about Obama, their opinions are poor. When they're asked about the Iran deal, they are much closer to Netanyahu than to where Obama is. That doesn't mean they think this was a good move. If you look at polling, most Israelis think it was a bad idea because of the crisis in the United States. Most Israelis think it was politically motivated. Cynicism is the rule in Israel, and it's probably right. Although it's against my standing rule, but it's probably correct. And in that sense, Israelis look at this sort of very poorly. All that said, I've said this elsewhere, a video, a clip like that is worth a million words. You see the prime minister coming into such an august forum. It's not that, you know, the Knesset is nice, but that's a really nice building over there downtown here. And you have all these people in suits and ties, and they're roaring, not just applauding. They roared when he entered the room, and they applauded everything he said. Israelis don't applaud anything, and so you see them applauding everything he says. The only thing people understand is that he just conquered the United States. It's very hard to explain that this is partly decorum, it's partly politics on the part of the senators and congressmen and women, and that the glaring absence of the president and others is a big deal.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code Lawfare 20. So talk about the impact on the U.S.-Israel relationship. On the one hand, I look at it and I say, you know, this relationship is not actually about two people. It's a quite deep relationship that depends on a lot of other variables. On the other hand, you know, the president is not wrong to feel grossly snubbed by the prime minister, and the prime minister is probably not wrong to think that the executive branch of the United States is doing everything it can behind the scenes to help his political opponents. What happens if and when 2 weeks from now Netanyahu is reelected and lo and behold Barack Obama is still in office and still negotiating with the Iranians? What happens then?
Well, I think less drama than one might think. If a deal is struck, Israel's going to sound the alarm and yell. But it did that about the interim agreement, too. Netanyahu called it an historic mistake. Very strong words, especially about Israel's one big ally. And so you're going to see drama around Iran. But fundamentally for the relationship, I don't think a whole lot is going to change in the short term. In the longer term, there can be some differences. Well, let me start with the long term. I'll get back to the short term in a minute. But in the longer term, the bipartisan issue is huge. Israelis, for a long time, long before this, have identified a risk of Israel becoming a Republican pet issue. If you think back to the debate, the foreign policy debate between Romney and Obama in the previous elections, Israel was mentioned, I think it was over 30 times. As China was much less. I don't remember the number. And that's not just because Israel's Americans love Israel. They do, but that's not the reason. The reason is that Romney identified a political weakness for Obama about Israel. And so he harped on it, because that's what good politicians do. And Obama knew exactly about this weakness, and like a good politician, he tried to defend himself on that, pointing out the very close security and intelligence cooperation, which is true, by the way, between the countries. That's why Israel came about so much. The danger for Israel and its supporters is that if this is strengthened and Israel becomes a Republican issue, they're going to lose a lot of the support they have from very important Democratic legislators. And the Democratic Party, if you look at demographics, is not on the descent, it's maybe on the ascent. And so for Israel, this is a very risky move. I think of it partly as a generational issue. The Democrats, many of the senior Democrats now who are so angry at Israel, and some of them saying public things that they really haven't said perhaps ever about Israeli leadership, they're not the problem for Israel. They, by and large, have squeaky clean Israel records, and they're going to vote for most of the things. But I'm thinking about the people who are 10 years younger, or slightly more, who are senior aides to these people. And they probably have mixed opinions about Israel, like about anything anyway. And they're now seeing cues from their leadership, from Nancy Pelosi, but not just her, from people on the center of the Democratic Party, too, speaking very differently about Israel than they did just 10 years ago. That, I think, can bode very ill for democratic support for Israel from the Israeli perspective, and in that sense, it's important.
And to what extent are the Bibi Netanyahus and Ron Dermers aware of this and concerned about this, and they've made a tactical judgment to risk it? And to what extent do you think it's just kind of not on their radar screen because they're not at all in tune with the democratic zeitgeist?
I think it's a combination of both again. I think on the Iran issue right now, they would say clearly, and I think they believe it, it's worth the risk. This, for them, certainly Netanyahu believes, this is an existential issue. It's a dramatic, historic, fateful, all these words that he's used, moment for Israel, and he needs to do everything, again Churchill in his mind, speak truth to power, truth to the world, unpopular truths, say it on the biggest stage you can. It's very much, I think, the way he perceives himself, perceives history, perceives this moment. That said, this isn't new. The democratic problem for Israel, or the potential one, has been around for a long time, and people have been talking about this for several years. People certainly, Israeli diplomats and others, are very well aware of this issue, but being aware and being truly attuned to it are different things. I doubt Ron Dermer and others are really aware of just how bad it is in some circles. They'll often point out that this, or they'll claim this is a beltway issue, that yes, if you talk to Democrats here in D.C., They'll say a variety of different things, but just go out to real America and you'll hear just how popular Israel is. And that is true. Israel is extremely popular. But this popularity isn't necessarily ironclad, and it's not ironclad in particular if the cues from the leadership are different. If democratic leaders speak differently, there are many very large populations in the United States who are not guaranteed to support Israel. And moreover, that also is correlated with party. If you look at conservative evangelical Christians, they are the most supportive of Israel now, and for sort of deep, sometimes faith issues, sometimes historical issues, they are ironclad. They also tend to be strongly Republican. Among the Democratic constituencies, you have people who have far less of an opinion, any kind of opinion, about Israel. Among minorities in particular, this summer we saw that. They're not hostile to Israel, but they don't have a predisposition necessarily to love it, and therefore they're taking very strong cues from their political leadership.
Well, and I would think they would also be taking very strong cues from the question of, you know, who the Israeli leadership is fighting with. That is, if you're a partisan of Barack Obama, one of the core Democratic interest groups or constituencies, and the Prime Minister treats the President, you know, quite disrespectfully in this episode, and allies himself very publicly with the President's domestic political enemies, you've kind of put yourself in your own box in terms of what, you know, a lot of people are going to think, at least in the short term.
Absolutely. And I think this is not appreciated in Israel, in part because the differences between the parties, again, from abroad, and I don't fault the Israelis for this, but it's not what they do day to day. It's not the way they think of politics. And so I think Israelis, by and large, miss this. It's not that Israeli diplomats don't understand all these issues. Of course they do. But they're fighting an uphill battle to a certain degree. And I do think that Netanyahu, in particular, is tone-deaf to these issues. He speaks naturally to Republicans. Again, nothing wrong with that, but that's just where he comes from. His ideology, in part, is very much attuned with theirs, but also the people he knows and the crowd he comes from. And naturally, it's going to be easier for him. I wouldn't be surprised. He's human, after all. I wouldn't be surprised that if you go through an experience like that in a joint session of Congress with those kinds of applause, you must feel okay about yourself and feel like you're doing something right. And you can forget that the two-time president is irate about this visit, and that a lot of Americans still like him. Even when he's very down on the polls, he's around 50%. That's 50% of Americans who really like the president, despite everything. It's just not a good idea in many respects.
So let's catch up on the state of the Israeli election. When you last joined us a couple months ago, I guess the election was just getting started, and it looked all but certain that Netanyahu would be returned as prime minister. Now I've looked at the polls over the last few days, and they do seem to have tightened a fair bit, particularly if you look at the bloc, the left bloc versus the right bloc. How do you game it out at this point?
I think you're right about the numbers. They have seemed to close the gap a little bit. But some of the momentum that the opposition had a bit after we spoke has dissipated. So let me go back to when we spoke. Shortly after that, there seemed to be a strong momentum in favor of Isaac Herzog, the opposition leader and the main challenger. In particular, there was a sense that among the elite, among the people too, but especially among the political elite, there's enormous amount of Bibi fatigue. And so although Netanyahu, the incumbent, and the numbers, the raw numbers, favored him, and they still do if you look at the polls, there's so many people who are sick and tired of him that there was a real chance of breaking his rule. And this stems from the Israeli political system. Even the night of the elections or the morning after, we won't really necessarily know who the prime minister is, because with a parliament that will probably have 11 factions, 10 or 11 factions in it, any one of these party leaders can decide many different things after the elections. Usually we know more or less what they'll do, and many of them we do know what they'll do, but some on the center we don't. And some of them may decide to break with Netanyahu. In particular, some of them have grievances with Netanyahu. So that gave momentum for the opposition and gave a real sense that it could happen this time. And even now, if I had to handicap the race, I'd say Netanyahu is certainly the favorite, but he's not a shoo-in. There really is a chance for Herzog to win. Since then, we've seen the numbers very, very lately improved somewhat for the opposition, both in terms of the two big parties, which are not very big, but the two largest parties. Herzog's party seems to be pulling slightly ahead of Netanyahu's Likud. But that's not what matters in Israeli politics. What matters is the blocs much more. And in that sense, the center-left has gained a little bit, but it still depends very much on kingmakers on the center. We mentioned, actually, last time we spoke, someone named Moshe Kahlon, who was expected to be the big surprise of these elections. He's underperforming from his best expectations, but he's going to be an important player. He's certainly going to be a minister in the next government, whoever forms it, and maybe the finance minister, which is what he wants. And he may be the kingmaker. You could look at the numbers and you can imagine a scenario in which he can decide who the next prime minister is. His natural inclination in many respects might be to go with Netanyahu, given his constituency and where he comes from. He's a former Likud minister himself. But he has a big score to settle with Netanyahu. He left the Likud because of a fight with Netanyahu. And he could decide to break with him. So in short, Netanyahu is still ahead, either heading a right-wing government or a national unity government where he brings in Herzog and Labour but rules as prime minister. But he's ahead not prohibitively. Herzog still has a real chance.
Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with, you guessed it, the Brookings Institute. We need your help in promoting the Lawfare podcast. Give us that 5-star rating on iTunes. Tweet about us. Share us on Facebook. Take a selfie of yourself listening to the Lawfare podcast. Be insufferable with your friends talking about us. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. This episode was edited by the estimable Cody Poplin. Thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.